The Guardian.
I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk. Coming up this week,
I have pursued a political career because of my sense of public duty, but I have too often put this before the interests of those I love most, and it is time to redress that balance.
So much for the new politics. We analyse immediate coverage of the David Laws affair. Also in the podcast,
we'll be covering all 64 games, so that wherever you are, heading out shopping or picking the kids up from school or working or whatever, you know and can be assured that if you tune in to Talk Sport, you'll hear every game.
Talk Sport's programme director Moz D tells us why a World Cup summer is vital for his station. Plus, the latest on the race to replace Mark Damaser as the controller of Radio 4, and...
Why do you have to shout Geronimo?
I didn't shout Geronimo!
Oh, yes, you did every single time, right in my ear hole.
Well, what else is there to shout?
Last of the summer wine finally runs dry after 37 years and 31 series. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. Now, the big sporting news this week was, of course, Theo Walcott's omission from the England World Cup squad. How that will impact on the team's fortunes in South Africa, only time will tell. But I can tell you that we've got the Maradona and Pele of podcasting here to boost our performance in this studio. And I don't mean that we're joined by a tax-evading cokehead or a Viagra salesman, because Paul Robinson is a squeaky clean broadcasting consultant and the managing director of Kidsco TV. Good to see you, as always, Paul.
Thank you very much. And squeaky clean, I quite like that. I'll keep that one. Thanks,
Keep
Matt.
That one. Paul is joined by Dan Subber. He's the former media editor of The Times and the brains behind BeehiveCity.com. No paywall around your media journalism, Dan.
Not yet, but you know, soon.
Soon. With all your traffic, you're bound to make some money out of
Quite
it.
Quite so.
Yes. Well, that's going to be our only reference, I promise, to paywalls this week. Let's get things going with a bit of politics.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
The last 2 days have been the longest and certainly the toughest of my life. And I'm very grateful indeed for the strong support which I've received from friends, from family, from colleagues and from constituents. The support of others is, of course, incredibly important, but ultimately I alone have the main responsibility for deciding how to react to recent events. I have therefore today spoken to the Prime Minister and to the Deputy Prime Minister to inform them of my decision to stand down from my role as Chief Secretary with immediate effect. This is my decision alone. I have an overriding responsibility to those I love most, and who I feel I have exposed to scrutiny in this way. I have pursued a political career because of my sense of public duty, but I have too often put this before the interests of those I love most, and it is time to redress that balance.
The Treasury chief, his secret lover, and the £40,000 expenses claim. That's how the Daily Telegraph broke the story of David Laws and his financial and not-so-financial affairs over the weekend, and we all know what happened next. Now, Mr. Laws can probably thank a bank holiday and the Israeli Defence Force for knocking his resignation from the Cabinet off the front pages sooner than expected, but still, what should we make of the media's handling of this saga, the first scandal to hit the new coalition just a couple of weeks in? We'll get the panel's thoughts in a moment, but first, let's speak to Jenny Russell, who's one of The Guardian's political commentators. Jenny, you wrote a piece on Commenters Free in which you took a pretty dim view of the press. Why was that?
I think it's decided to assume the worst motives in anybody who makes any mistakes. And I think that in the David Laws affair, the assumption was made from the start that this was a man who was obviously trying to milk money from the taxpayer, who was corrupt in some way. And that impression was fed by the way the media reported the story. The Daily Mail, for instance, described Laws as the Treasury axeman caught funneling at least £40,000 of public money to his secret gay lover. And nowhere in the story was there any sense of perspective. There was no understanding of the fact that Laws is a man who clearly wasn't motivated by money. He gave up a very well-paid city career for public service. And his breach of the parliamentary rules in this case was an entirely technical affair. He chose to rent a room from his lover. He paid a market rate for it. And yet, had he chosen to claim a very much larger sum from the taxpayer in expenses to buy or rent his own flat, he could have had his partner living in it rent-free. So this is not a case of a man trying to maximise his take from the taxpayer, and yet it was presented almost everywhere with vindictive glee as an act of an evil and corrupt man.
But do you think that there's any change in the press's actions? This is the way the press in the UK always is, isn't it? It's not a new thing.
I think the press has always had a tendency to do this, but I think that two things have changed. I think, first of all, that the BBC, which always used to stand back in the past from stories and think carefully about the tone of its own reporting, has now taken very often to picking up the press's lead, not only on stories, but on the tone of stories, so that it doesn't stand back and ask, what is the motivation here? What's really going on? It just joins in the howling pack. And I think that makes a huge difference, because the advent of 24-hour news and of so many news programmes means that the punch doesn't really catch on unless the BBC has joined in too, and the BBC now does. And that very swiftly affects the whole atmosphere in which any news story develops. And it makes it almost impossible for anybody to stand back and say, hang on a moment, what was the motive there? What's really going on?
Do you think there? I mean, obviously there was the juicy addition of the fact that he was gay and the fact that we didn't know he was gay. Is that element of it significant, do you think? Is there people, some people say there's latent homophobia in the press. What's your view on that?
Clearly that was an element of the story which some of the press chose to play up in a rather unpleasant way, as if it was made any difference whether the man that Laws was living with was his secret gay lover, whether that would have been different had it been a woman. But I think that that is less important than the fact that politicians now have been so tarnished by the expensive scandal that any error by any of them is now seen through the light of duck houses and moats and all the rest of it. And we've moved really to a culture of contempt, I think, in public life, which I don't think is healthy for all of us, because it feeds the idea that anybody in public life is probably either a charlatan, a fool, or a liar. I don't think that's very good for us, because it means that we then feel that we are led by people that we cannot respect or trust in any way.
Okay, Jenny Russell, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks, Jenny. Dan, you were listening to that. Pick up on Jenny Russell's last point, that the press automatically assumes that there is bad in everybody. Is that right?
I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think even that's the case in this case. And I have to say, unfortunately, I disagree with what Jenny said, or the well-expressed their point of view is. I think this is an entirely legitimate story by The Telegraph. This was... And frankly, if David Laws thought it was OK, he would still be Chief Secretary of the Treasury. And indeed, if David Cameron thought it was OK, he would have been a bit more forthcoming when the story broke in his support for Mr. Laws.
Yeah, because the first statements that came out were pretty equivocal.
Pretty lukewarm, one got the impression. Well, I would love to know who turned the Telegraph onto this story, so to speak. And could be quite an interesting little point to make. But the bottom line here is that there was an undisclosed financial relationship, and that was a breach of the rules.
So Jenny Russell's point is that, well, he could have claimed more if he declared his partnership, but I wonder whether that's really the point at all. It was the covering up, as is always the case in these.
The tragedy of the situation, certainly the tragedy for David Laws is that, yes, he could have done any number of other things and been more candid, not that one is obliged to be candid about one's sexuality, but one is obliged to be candid about the fact that if you're paying, government money, public money to your partner, I think people do have a right to know that. I think people have a right to know what your, what influences you, what your attachments are, what your relationships are. That's just a fact of public life. It might not be a comfortable fact all the time, but that's the way it goes.
Paul Robinson, are you with Jenny or are you with Dan?
I am with Dan. I mean, I think my view would be this, and that is that the mood of the country is that there's deep distrust of politicians. There's been, a massive amount of exposure of stories of people fiddling, and this really is another fiddling, really. And so I think it's therefore perfectly...
Lots of
fiddling going on, and therefore I think it's justifiable for the press to expose it. Now, it's nothing to do with the fact he was gay. That's completely irrelevant. There seemed to be some attempt by him...
I
think it's completely irrelevant. I mean, clearly, the fact he was outed by virtue of this story, is maybe interesting, cause no one knew he was gay, but it's nothing to do with the fact he was actually claiming from a partner and hadn't disclosed it, and then was caught having not disclosing it. And whether it revolves around the technicality of, what did we have separate bank accounts and different social lives, and therefore we weren't really partners, and therefore let's debate what partner means.
I
didn't buy that at all. Look, he lives with his partner, totally fine, but he should not be using government money to pay for accommodation. I mean, he just shouldn't, and he should have disclosed it, and he chose not to, and he got caught, and sorry, he pays the penalty penalty for that.
Well, what about this idea though, that the press just automatically assumes that there is bad in everybody? There is a sort of a there is a baying pack element of this, isn't there?
I'm not sure. Look, I thought that there was a little bit of, you know, overzealous commentary at times, and I thought there was a little bit of, you know, almost homophobic comment. I mean, I think there's sort of a glee. Oh, you know, he's paying his lover, and his lover is a man. There was a bit of that, but in terms of exposing misuse of public money, I think it's entirely appropriate and legitimate, and I think it got the tone right.
I think a Telegraph's front page story was factual, down the line, accurate, and didn't sensationalise. There has been an awful lot of commentary, both, you know, there's been some commentary of the kind Paul's just described. There's been an awful lot of commentary the other way around,
Richard,
as well.
Richard Littlejohn, I consider all Liberal MPs to be homosexuals unless furnished with concrete proof otherwise.
Well, there we are. Wonderful. I can't say I agree with that, but I think, look at what Matthew Parris is saying in the Times. I think the Times was certainly very unhappy very unhappy about the coverage about the resignation. There was, you know, there was more than one point of view out there very strongly from the off.
I think that sort of wraps up all the relevant issues for that story. Thank you very much to both of you. If you want to give us your feedback, our blog's at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk, and the politics continues as we move into our news in brief section. And I want to talk about Adam Bolton, who has apologised for getting really hot under the collar with Alastair Campbell live on Sky. 1,000 people complained to Ofcom. Is this the end of the matter? Did you catch this? Have you YouTubed it?
We caught it, YouTubed it, put it up on our website within minutes. And
BeehiveCity.com.
Thank you very much. And the readers and viewers loved it. Yeah. I think this is it's a bit late for this apology. With your all due respect to Adam,
and
I think
he was on the Today programme talking about other matters, and he was
he's perfectly capable of apologising any other way much more quickly. I think what I'd say is that Adam's a wonderfully professional broadcaster, and I thought the attitude of Sky News, perhaps on his behalf or otherwise, is a little bit curious. Yes, you know, the bottom line is he lost his temper with Alastair Campbell. That was compelling television, but for a professional like him, what did John Sargent say, I think, on the radio? It's not in the job. That's not in the job description. And actually, what does Sky News do? They put out... You know, they put out images of the row. They put out a transcript. It was on YouTube. That wasn't their doing, but, you know, that's the modern world. And they kind of reveled in it. Mm. And I don't have a problem with Sky News doing that necessarily in one sense, because, yes, it's good TV. But, hell, if I was the reporter in that situation, I would feel desperately uncomfortable.
Yes, it was one of those when newsreaders go bad moments, wasn't it?
He went really bad, and I think he lost quite a lot of respect over that. I think he made a mistake in apologising so late. I suspect, as Dan said, Sky News were quite happy to have the publicity. You know, it helped them to get more awareness, and it was a gossip point in the pub and talking point, and that was obviously good for Sky News. But I think for Adam, I think this has been not a good affair, and I think he needs to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, naughty Adam. On to the radio. Radio 4 Control, a long list apparently of 14, but Paul, your horse isn't on it.
No, I don't know what happened. Parfit has fallen at the first hurdle. Yeah. I mean, goodness only knows. He was my hot tip, and hey,
make it to the first. You see, it's the curse of your endorsement.
Yes. What's interesting, you see, is people. I read some of the comments on MediaGuardian.co.uk as well, and it's interesting how people said, you know, Parfit being Radio 4. What they don't know is actually he has got a very good track record in speech radio. He started in speech radio. He worked at Radio 4 and the old Radio.
He's quite a serious, thoughtful man.
He is a serious, thoughtful man. So that's why I thought he's a good contender. But clearly, I was wrong.
Yeah. Well, so who do you think's up for it? George Entwistle, they say. Janice Hadlow, bit TV-ish, maybe.
I can't see Janice Hadlow going for it. I mean, control of BBC Two. I think George Entwistle's interesting. I mean, he's been around, you know, a long time, respected BBC knowledge. I mean, certainly a contender, I would say.
Kerry Thomas, maybe a bit tainted by the early programme.
A bit early too, I think.
What about Adrian Van Cleverclogs?
Well, Adrian would be a good choice, but they probably need him at Radio 5 Live. I mean, you know, Radio 5 Live's just changed its schedule. It's going through a bit of a change, really, both in terms of its overall mission and its lineup. So I wouldn't have thought Adrian. I think Graham Ellis is a possibility.
Right.
You know, Graham's been, he's controller of production, you know, big BBC job, never actually been a controller of a network. And I suspect he might like to do that. He's highly capable, editorially very strong, you know, clearly he's a heavyweight intellectually. He understands news. You know, he would be certainly a safe pair of hands, if not better than that.
If not better than that, that's very safe pair of hands, if not better. Excellent. What about anyone from outside the BBC? Is Peter Barron being paid too much by Google?
Peter Barron won't do it. I mean, I think the name from outside I think is interesting is Tim Souter.
Oh, yes.
Tim is another...
Ex-Ofcom.
Ex-Ofcom. He was BBC production before right. that, of course. He knows the BBC very well. You know, Tim is also fiercely bright, understands editorial policy, understands the politics of broadcasting and the BBC, hasn't done a big job like that. I mean, Tim would be, I think, a very, very interesting outside candidate.
Okay. Would you like to take us on down to... Mariella Frostrup, or have you more to say about Radio 4 Controller?
I was only going to say on the controller thing, two things. I think Peter Barron is interested. That's my sense of one. And let that hang. Yeah. And I don't know if Rolly Keating was on your list of 14 or where he's gone, but there were certainly...
Rolly's on every list, isn't he?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I mean, Rolly's lovely, but he is on every job list.
He's cerebral and thoughtful, and Radio 4 is a job for
and
a polymath.
And he's grey. You know, he's got that. He's got grey hair, yeah.
He's got grey hair.
I suppose the outgoing controller had no hair at all.
No
but I think, you know, You have to be. I know that. Let me tell you. I went for a controller's job at the BBC many years ago, and I was told
you haven't got
enough grey hair.
Really?
I was told that by John Burt.
It's not enough
grey hair. Seriously, I was rejected for that.
You don't have any grey hair now.
That was actually Radio 2 as
that
well.
That was the you should have stopped using the Just for Men.
I should have done absolutely. If only I was using it.
Yeah,
I can also get some grey hair highlights. Maybe that's what
we should do. That. What about Mariella Frostrup? Dan, she's apologised for her frosty strop about the Today programme. She said it was being run by a bunch of misogynists in a unguarded interview in The Lady magazine.
Why is it that people apologise for things they shouldn't apologise for like that, and then Adam Bolton takes forever perhaps
presumably
to apologise?
She doesn't want to get fired from Radio 4.
Well, yeah, but I sort of think she's right.
Yeah, I think she's kind of right. I mean,
she's kind of right. I mean, I do think... Look,
I mean, not that they're overtly misogynist going around saying how bad women are, but there's an undercurrent of... I can't see how they could have failed to have appointed a woman in all these years if there isn't an undercurrent.
I can't either. Look, I do all the Today programme. It's my sort of main source of news and information while I'm sort of feeling, in pain behind the eyes because I don't like the morning very much. And yet, look, it definitely needs... It could do with a refresh and a sort of a bit of change in tone, I think. I mean, Evan Davis has brought some of that, but it's just sort of, relentless kind of pummeling interviews. And I like relentless pummeling interviews, but I would like a bit of a change, and I'd like some variety, and I'd like a slightly different
I like
type.
Keep Radio 4 stuffy. I think Keep Radio 4 stuffy and where it is a campaign I want to... Yeah, no, I can't agree.
Okay,
I like it as it is.
I'll have to disagree with you on that. Well, I think Mariella should be, given a slot. And
give her a slot on Radio 4. Yeah,
certainly try her out. I'd like to see some summertime coming up. Let's see some interesting guest presenters.
Yeah,
not just Nick Robinson.
Is he about to join the gang, do you think?
That's been the talk, hasn't it, for a long time. And I think his tryout, he did rather well in his tryout.
Yeah.
And it must be wearing being political editor, even though it comes with all the... accoutrements of celebrity. It does.
Talking about ladies in the radio, Fru Haslett is back in business, except it's not in the radio. Well, she was the former Virgin Radio and GCAP chief executive, and she's going to become the new, managing director of commercial and online.
Yes, doing two people's jobs. Yes. At the moment.
Well, if one has met, if you've met Fru, and you and I have, she's eminently capable of doing
Fru is a bundle of energy. Yeah. I guess you look at her experience, in online at Yahoo, in advertising sales at Capital, ITV now sensibly looking to diversify beyond mere spot sales on television. All of the agencies say to you, if you want to maximise revenue, sell the two screens together, sell the online with the TV. She's going to have that in one place, in one division. It seems a very smart move to me.
I just realised we were going on about Radio 4 being too male, and I'm just looking around the podcast table. We did have a woman on.
Maybe you should put a dress on next week.
Let's just not go down that route. It takes us on nicely to Eurovision, because there were a few men in dresses.
I've got a polka knot down where I could wear.
Just stop it. Did anyone watch Eurovision?
No, and I think we should stop this nonsense now.
See, it's very sensible when Dan Sabah's on the programme. We have
no Eurovision. No. I mean, we talk about Eurovision, I'm delighted to, but it just shouldn't be on BBC One.
Oh, really?
Stop it.
Oh, rubbish.
Why? Why is
it? It's fun.
It's fun.
The problem is we are not very good at it.
I don't care that we're not very good at it. It does nothing for music. It does nothing for culture. It is trite and nonsense. We do not have, we don't have Miss World. We don't have Crufts. We shouldn't have Eurovision.
It's not about music. Dan, at all, is it? It's about a bit of fun. Yeah. I didn't see it this year. I was actually in Warsaw, and I'm really sad I missed it because I like to be in the UK to watch Eurovision.
Yes.
And it's just a laugh, you know? I mean, I'm disappointed that we are so poor. I mean, it was a desperate.
Again.
But not nil point, thank goodness.
Did you see the show? I can't remember. We did have a go about it on Media Talk, the show in which they chose.
Yes.
It was just the worst programme I've seen forever.
Look, we are capable of making good television. We're also capable of making great music. The trouble is that nobody who's notable, Simon Cowell or whoever, would actually want to risk their reputation on Eurovision. But we need someone who's going to do a good job. We did have people in the past who did that, and I won't mention any names because where they went wasn't very savoury. But the point was, we have in the past done better.
We
can do better. And Eurovision, the problem with Eurovision is it's dominated now by the Eastern Bloc. It's become Eastern Europe Vision.
Well,
that's the problem with it.
No, it's not. Germany won, didn't they?
And yes,
there was in Norway this year. Get your facts right.
But Yugoslavia's got about four different votes now, and Russia and its satellites have got 10 votes. So it's gone a bit Eastern.
Let them get on with it. What sticks in my throat is that when it comes to sort of prime time music programming on the BBC, we get Eurovision. And what we should have is we don't have Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
We should have something like that. We have serious music decent music or mainstream popular music is
Jules
in late
Collins,
night.
Late night.
You know why?
Because it rates badly.
No, it adds no unique reach. The trouble with music on BBC One is it adds no unique reach. That's why there's no music on BBC One.
Why don't we just let the British music industry go down the Swanee with no support from the BBC television?
I think that's enough on that. I think we know where you stand, Dan. Sad news to end the section with. The world's longest running but least funny sitcom has ended. Last of the Summer Wine has been canned after 37 years, as I said earlier, in 31 series. You can't imagine Peep Show or, God forbid, My Family still around in 2040, can you, Dan? Are you a My Family fan?
I'm like fond of My Family. Last of the Summer Wine was still on.
Well, they brought it back, didn't they?
So embarrassing.
Yes.
I was sort of dimly aware of being brought back, and I thought,
is Peter Sellers still alive?
Yes.
I'm not sure which of the original cast are still in it, but yes.
Well, he must be because he's doing Wallace, isn't he?
Yeah, he's still alive. He's rather old. I didn't know it was on, so I'm rather embarrassed to admit it. One is touched that it was still there, but I obviously didn't like it enough to watch it.
It's astonishing about how the longevity of programs like this that I never understand how the Antiques Roadshow is still on after all these years, and that's this sort of twee. Perhaps reminder of an England that is now past does resonate.
It does, and I think Antiques Roadshow's got a bit of a sort of got legs to it really, because in a way it's about making money out of your attic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's a sort of perennial thing. Yeah. And it's they've changed presenters and modernised it, but it is rather English. It sort of goes with cucumber sandwiches, Sunday afternoon, a little stroll in the park and all that sort of stuff.
A little part of England has died with the demise of Last of the Summer Wine. Yeah, okay, thank you very much. We'll wrap that around there. And there's more on all these stories, of course, at mediaguardian.co.uk.
Big name, big game radio.
Hi, I'm Joe Cole. You follow the World Cup on TalkSport.
Game on!
Official broadcaster of the FIFA 2010 World Cup, South Africa.
It's off the line!
No one is more committed to bringing you the best coverage of the football in South Africa this summer. Big Game Radio. Talk Sport.
I love those kinds of ads. It's one of the typically excellent promos currently playing on Talk Sport. Of course, no coincidence that they picked up the Sony Gold for their commercials at this year's awards. The World Cup is about to launch itself upon us, as we know. We can't move for reminders of it. Next month, the TV and radio schedules will be dominated by the event. Anyway, with his white van and St George's flag at the ready, Media Talk producer Ben Green spoke to Moz D, who's Talk Sport's programme director, to find out about his station's World Cup offering.
Well, first off, you don't need a white van, by the way. Yes, clearly, those who drive white vans are very welcome to Talk Sport, but audience breakdowns are to be believed, there are lots of people right around the UK who are looking forward to the World Cup, who are in all sorts of different demographics and all sorts of different industries. And it's one of those things that brings in and unites the whole country. It's one of those moments, one of the few left, that everybody throughout the whole family is affected by. So even people who don't ordinarily follow football all of a sudden get caught up in the melee, in the sound, in the colour, in the atmosphere. And on Talk Sport, we've got an advantage, perhaps an advantage over others. That being, namely, we're called Talk Sport. So it sort of does what it says on the tin. And the World Cup is our opportunity to really shine in this area. We'll be covering all 64 games. So whilst, you know, TV will command huge audiences, whether it be the BBC or the ITV, they won't be doing all the games. TalkSport as a radio station will. So that wherever you are, you know, heading out shopping or picking the kids up from school or working or whatever, you know and can be assured that if you tune into TalkSport, you'll hear every game. And that with sort of a continuous running analysis. And what we want to create is that real sort of surround sound that whenever you tune in, you'll get the very latest on what's happening in South Africa. And hopefully that'll become a real point of difference for people.
So, Miles, how many staff are you taking to South Africa?
A lot less than the BBC.
And how much is it costing you?
I can't.
A lot less than the BBC.
A lot less than the BBC. I mean, my last World Cup was at the BBC. I was at Five Live at the time. In fact, I did two World Cups with them, Japan and Korea, which was extraordinary, and the World Cup in Germany, which was a fantastic success as well. And, you know, the one thing you do miss being in the commercial world is that type of resource, and it's huge resource. You know, it is what it is, but what we have to look at is what we can do that the BBC can't. And again, I keep going back, mantra-like, to the fact that Five Live, when it's fulfilling its service license agreement, is 25% sport and 75% news. We're sport. That's what we do. We have the ability to talk about football at breakfast, to talk about it at lunchtime, to talk about it at drive time, and at the same time bring you all the games live. So that's our differential. That's our point of difference at this period.
And just how important is it for you that England have a good competition and stay in the competition?
Hugely. Not just from, you know, from a commercial aspect, not so much, because I know that we've sold out of our inventory already. So, you know, the commercial aspect of what we've done is sort of done and dusted for the World Cup. And I'm very proud to say we have a list of very prestigious sponsors who've backed us and are supporting England and supporting TalkSport throughout this tournament, which is absolutely fantastic. But in terms of listeners, in terms of that atmosphere that I talked about earlier on, it's imperative that England stay within the tournament and do as well as they possibly can, because that keeps the whole mood of the nation buoyant, keeps that expectation. You know what it's like. You know, when are they playing now? Next, you know, you're getting your mates round, you're talking about where you'll be if you're watching or listening to it. It keeps that heightened that heightened sense of excitement, and it's very important that England do as well as they can. And if they win it, can you imagine what that'll be like? I mean, I think that'll work both in terms of audience, because hopefully people will trial us, perhaps for the first time this World Cup, move forward with us. But also commercially, I think there'd be a huge lift for everybody if England were to go on and win it. So it's vitally important.
Mosdy there. Paul Robinson, you know a bit about all of this, having been managing director of TalkSport's predecessor station, Talk Radio. And the commercial aspect that he mentioned at the end there, that's what this is all about, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, for TalkSport, they will obviously compete with Radio 5 Live, who'll get a bigger audience than they will. But TalkSport will get an increase in audience. But most of all, they've got a unique opportunity on radio to provide a place for clients to put their brands next to World Cup commentary. And TalkSport will actually make very significant revenue out of this.
Well, and Dee says that they've sold out of their inventory already.
I'm not surprised. I mean, yeah. It's interesting they've actually sold it now, but I guess in radio they probably wanted to make sure they got the bookings and got the money in
the
bank.
Well, yeah, because you would have thought maybe, Dan, that they would have held some inventory back in order if England gets through to charge a premium price.
That's what I understand ITV has done.
Right.
They've done pretty well. I think they're up sort of 25%, roughly speaking, in both June and July. So, you know, July's looking pretty good. But, yeah, look, if England sort of start progressing through the tournament, then they want to try and go for that extra bit of money. The interesting thing, though, is the medium term. I think Moz was talking there about sort of practically sort of if England won the World Cup, that would probably save the nation, the economy, the Conservative government, you know, our marriages or whatever it is. And I think the reality I'm hearing certainly from the TV side is, no, things are going to tighten up and it's going to look tough from the second half. So yes, the World Cup will be great, but
no long-term no sort of medium to long-term benefit uplift, you don't think?
That's not the way they're planning at ITV, right? Anyway, that's very much the sense I got. It might be a bit different for TalkSport.
I think TalkSport may well build some client relationships they can then actually leverage beyond that, and they may get some commercial benefit after it. In terms of audience, in 1998 when we did this. Talk Radio then put on about 400,000 listeners, which was about 20% increase in reach. So very, very healthy increase, and held on to about half of that. So if Talk Sport can do something similarly, that's worth, you know, money to them on an ongoing basis.
Mosdy was teasing the BBC about the number of their staff that they're sending. 295 staff to South Africa, plus a flat pack studio. 110 hours across BBC One and BBC Two. 250 hours on Five Live. ITV are sending 150 staff to South Africa. And in 2006, 19.9 million people watched England's game with Sweden. So, I mean, these are huge, huge investment that's being made. All the, you know, the papers are sending, you know, big staff and big investment. There's a lot of money going into all of this.
There is, but that will pay back. I'd be interested to know what Talk Sport's doing. I would predict less than 20 people. I mean, there are some days when they've
fewer
than 20 people. Thank you. Yeah. You're not the only person who corrects me on my
grammar.
I won't go there. There are obviously some occasions that would be interesting for Talk Sport where there are two matches happening at the same time. Yeah. So although they're covering every single match, they clearly can't cover, you know, every match, you know, kick by kick.
Yes. You've done your research.
I brought my little coloured chart with me. Yes.
What does it tell us?
It tells us that for TV it's very good because most of the England matches are actually in the evening, which is prime time. There's only one England match in the group game, which is actually 4 o'clock kickoff, which would be pretty good for Talk Sport in terms of audience because people will be at work, so they might well be listening to the radio or, as happened in the World Cups in the past, watching the TV and listening to the radio commentary.
Yeah, all right. Any other World Cup observations, Dan, before we...
I can't really wait for it to start, actually, yeah. Which is perhaps suitably banal kind of observation. I think ITV have got the two peak time games in the group phase, then BBC have got the 4 yes. o'clock, which I can't now remember which game that is. And then curiously, a funny bit of jiu-jitsu, I think the BBC have both the second round and the quarter final, and then ITV and BBC share the semis if England get there, where of course ITV will be smashed in the viewing. Yes. So I'm not quite sure. I know ITV want the certainty of two peak time England games for that near 20 million audience, which is likely, but I can't help thinking that maybe the BBC have done all right, because you'd have to bet on England making certainly the second round and should be the quarters. They've got
well,
a
they always
generous
the quarter
draw.
And then
quarters, and then that's where they're at risk of falling out. Yeah.
That's what you say, but you know.
Well,
who knows? Argentina in 98 was a pretty tough game.
What do I know? Listen, James Richardson is our World Cup man. He's fronting our own World Cup podcast. You'll find them at guardian.co.uk/World Cup Daily. And we have a television advert. I don't know if you've seen our television advert, but it's good. It's gone out. It's about the rest of the Guardian and Observer's World Cup output. And here it is.
World Cup. Every 4 years it's the World Cup. If you don't pick up a groin strain in the build-up, then we'll love it when you score a goal.
Ooh, did you see that?
World Cup. It might all end in tears or a headbutt. You can follow all the blogging on your laptop. From Slovenia to Slovakia, from Nigeria to the Côte d'Ivoire.
Ah, Côte d'Ivoire.
The Guardian and Observer, packed with World Cup coverage every day.
It's a very catchy tune. The time's almost up, but before we go, Dan and Paul, you're sort of gallivanting sort of chaps. You lunch and wine and dine people, don't you? What have you learnt from your contacts in the last seven days?
I've learned how to miss stories from point blank range. I had a jolly meeting with Rupert Howell. He then resigned as ITV's head of commercial 2 days later and only hinted it to me obliquely. I was having a nice email exchange with Fru Haslett yesterday, and today she's got his job at ITV. So what a bystander to the action I am.
It's just as well you're not the media editor of the Times anymore, isn't it?
Yes.
Paul, how about you?
Oh, well, I've just been, you know, doing my usual thing of flying off to countries far and wide. Actually, been very, very good. The last few weeks, I managed to keep my credit card in my pocket more times than it's come out. I don't know how I've managed it, but I usually play this game when I'm with someone at dinner, you know, not to sort of reach for the wallet too quickly. And then when it gets to a point where you've had coffee and you've been talking for a while, I think, well, maybe I should. And I haven't, and the person's paid, I think, the last six times, so I think that's pretty good.
You're just tight, aren't you?
I'm just tight. Well, I'm just saving money, you know, for the company.
Well,
I hope the bosses are listening.
Yeah. Well, I should just say that one of the stories that we haven't covered this week, but that happened in the last week, was the very sad death of Alan Ruddock, who is the former editor of The Scotsman and most recently a columnist on the Sunday Independent in Dublin, who was the editor of The Scotsman when I was there and gave him my job job in London, which was sort of the kickstart of my career. So it was his fault. Very sad. 49, playing cricket, doing something that he really, really loved. He was a very, very nice man. So RIP Alan Ruddock. Thank you very much, Dan Sabat and Paul Robinson. Emily Bell and Maggie Brown will be here next week. But in the meantime, head over to our blog at guardian.co.uk/MediaTalk. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. See you next time. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.